I go into my boss and I say, I'm going to leave. And I jump off the cliff. I disrupt myself with no real plan other than I'm going to be an entrepreneur. Sometimes that's what you have to do. It looks very foolhardy in retrospect, but sometimes you just have to do it because you know you have to do it.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Famous Failures. I'm your host, Ozan Morol. Today's guest on the show is Whitney Johnson. Whitney is a leading business thinker and an expert on disruptive innovation and personal disruption. She covers the framework for personal disruption in the critically acclaimed book, Disrupt Yourself, Putting the Power of Disruptive Innovation to Work. Originally an award-winning stock analyst, Whitney chose to leave her Wall Street career behind at the height of her career. This bold act of personal disruption and the following years of entrepreneurial exploration led to her new career as a writer, speaker, and business coach. Whitney is the host of the popular Disrupt Yourself podcast. You can gain special insights into her 7-point framework for personal disruption by listening to episode 120. I'll link to that in the show notes. The episode is called Disrupt Yourself. The title is Play to Your Distinctive Strengths, and you can find that at whitneyjohnson.com/distinctive-strengths. In the episode, Whitney and I talk about how Whitney went from being a secretary to award-winning Wall Street analyst at a Wall Street firm, why taking a step backward was Whitney's slingshot forward on Wall Street, how disrupting yourself can set you up for greater success, why Lady Gaga and Steve Martin are the perfect examples of personal disruption, the three factors that helped Whitney develop the confidence to make big leaps, and finally, the importance of grieving failure. Before I play the interview, I wanted to let you know that my new book, Think Like a Rocket Scientist, is now available for pre-order. If you pre-order the book, you'll get immediate digital access to read on your favorite device. That means you can start reading the book now, months before the book is published. You'll also get pre-order bonuses worth at least 10 times the cost of the book. You can find out about the pre-order bonuses and links to order the book at rocketsciencebook.com. I've been ecstatic about the early reviews of the book. The book was named a must-read by Susan Cain, who is the New York Times bestselling author of Quiet, Endlessly Fascinating by Daniel Pink, who is the New York Times bestselling author of Drive, and Bursting with Practical Insights by Adam Grant, who is the New York Times bestselling author of Originals. You might be wondering why I'm running a pre-order campaign at all and why it might make sense to pre-order the book now. As I mentioned, you'll get bonuses if you pre-order the book that disappear on the day that the book is released. That's one reason. Second, I'm donating a 100% of my royalties from the pre-order sales, up to $10,000, to a nonprofit called Charity Water, which is on a mission to create a future where everyone has access to clean and safe drinking water. My goal is to sponsor an entire water project, which will cost $10,000 and bring clean water to a community of about 300 people. By pre-ordering the book, you'll help bring this goal to life. And finally, pre-orders carry tremendous weight in book promotion. Major bookstores use pre-order numbers to gauge public interest in the book. If the pre-order numbers are high, they'll stock more copies of the book, which in turn means more readers will see it. So I hope you'll check it out. It's at rocketsciencebook.com. Without further ado, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Whitney Johnson. And thank you, as always, for listening. Whitney, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ozan. I am delighted to be here.
You have so many remarkable achievements in your background, but I want to start with one of your earlier ones. You mentioned this in your book, Disrupt Yourself, but I'd love to dig a little bit deeper. So you went from being a secretary at a Wall Street firm to award-winning stock analyst. How exactly did that happen? Can you walk us through that transition or that progress?
So basically what happened is I arrived in New York. My husband was getting his PhD at Columbia in microbiology, and we get to New York and I've majored in music. And didn't turn out that Wall Street was really looking for music majors, especially not female music majors. And yet my husband and I, funnily enough, we needed to eat. So I just went out and I got a job and I started as a secretary. across from my desk, there's like this big bullpen and it's young stockbrokers. It turns out they're all male. This is the era of Liar's Poker and Working Girl. And so, you know, really intense pressure. And so they say things like, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that this is a good trade, which of course you will appreciate. And then they'd say things that hit a little bit more closely home, which is throw down your pom-poms and get in the game. And at first I was a little offended because I was a cheerleader in high school. But after hearing that over and over again, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to be working at least 5 years. Why am I going to make X when 10X is a possibility? I need to throw down my pom-poms and get in the game, my game. And so that started me on this, you know, taking business courses at night, accounting, finance, economics. And then importantly, I had a boss who believed in me and was like, we're going to move you from being a secretary to an investment banker. And if you've been in financial services, you know, that doesn't happen. This happened about 2 years in. I did banking for about 4 or 5 years. And then there was a merger and a big shakeup, and my boss was fired. I was moved, but actually I was shoved into equity research. And it turns out, though, that that was a career maker for me. So I was disrupted in this instance, moved into equity research. But I was a really good stock picker. I was good at building financial models, but what I was really good at was spotting momentum in stocks. And turns out in people now, I've discovered, which is really my calling. But that's what happened is I started on Wall Street out of necessity, making money so that we could eat. And then I decided, hey, I want this. I want this brass ring. I take classes at night. I get promoted because I have a good boss. Then I get disrupted into equity research. But it turns out for me that sideways, that step back was a slingshot forward. And so to your initial question, I was an institutional investor ranked equity analyst for 8 years before I, this time, disrupted myself to go become an entrepreneur.
Right. Before we get to that part, I want to go back to something you said before. So when your boss got fired, you said you were shoved into equity research. It sounds like this was an involuntary disruption. Am I characterizing that correctly?
It was almost involuntary. Okay. So what, it was kind of a hybrid. So it turns out this is 1996. I think in retrospect, they probably would have let me go too, except for there were two things that were happening. One was I'd had really good reviews, and two, I was pregnant. And you don't let people go that are pregnant with really good reviews. And so they're like, well, what do we do with her? And, you know, we looked around in investment banking, and there was one senior person, and I was so grateful because he was like taking an interest in me. And I thought it was because he really liked me, and maybe he did, but I think they were also like, what are we going to do with her? So they finally said, well, why don't you go do equity research? And the reason I say shoved is that if you know the ecosystem within financial services, equity research is a step back from investment banking. But for me, it turns out that my skills were much more suited. Equity research is very entrepreneurial. It's like you've got this whole bank behind you, but then you've got your own franchise within the bank and you're putting buys and sells on stock and building out your own franchise. So I was kind of shoved. In fact, I was shoved, but sometimes, and you know, this is the theme of this podcast, in many ways, that was the best thing that ever happened to my career, is that I was almost forced into doing something that I would never have chosen to do, but it turned out to be really, really great for my career.
Right. And that reminded me of something that Steve Jobs said too, right after he was pushed out of Apple, and I think it was in 1985 or 1986. And he said, you know, it felt terrible to be pushed out of the company that he co-founded, but it allowed him to enter one of the most creative periods of his life. He ended up starting Next, and he then joined Pixar and turned it into this, you know, blockbuster studio. And it sounds like, you know, something similar happened to you with getting into equity research, which ended up being, as you said, much better, much more suited for your skill set.
This sideways was a slingshot. And I actually want to put a finer point on that story that you just told about Steve Jobs, because I remember reading somewhere that when he got fired, he was curled up in a ball on his couch,
right,
wondering if he would ever survive this true for him tragedy. And I think that that's an important moment of like when something that we care about deeply does not work. It is absolutely devastating. And the things that we care, you know, like we all fail all the time. And most of the time we're like, okay, that didn't work, next, that didn't work, next. But when there's something that goes to our identity, there's this sense of we have, the way I think about it is, are you going to kill me dead? And in that moment is Steve Jobs. And for most of us, if there's something that we really care deeply about, we feel like we've been killed dead. And, you know, how do we come back from that? At least that's been my experience.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you mentioned that important part of Steve Jobs' story, because it's one thing to say, oh, in hindsight, this failure was a blessing in disguise and all of these wonderful things happened to me as a result. But in the moment when you're going through it, especially if it's your baby, as you said, something that you wrapped your identity around, it's so hard to not get curled up in a ball as Steve Jobs did, and to keep marching forward, to zoom out, to be able to see what this could mean 5 years or 10 years down the road. It's only in hindsight that you could look back and say, well, you know what, that was awesome for me. You then rose up through the ranks, became an award-winning stock analyst. And then while you're at the top of your Wall Street game, you quit. Why did you leave?
For a number of reasons. And as with any decision like this, there are almost always like two or three or four or five reasons. And so if I look at all the different things that were coming together, so it's been 8 years. I'm now at the top of my game. I'm institutional investor ranked in not just one category, but two categories. So number one in media in Latin America, was covering America Mobile. So basically emerging markets. And then number two in telecom, I'm sorry, media, Televisa, telecom, America Mobile, and Telmex. It feels like it's time for me to do something new. And I go to my boss and I say, hey, you know, I'd like to, in my parlance, jump to a new S curve. I'd like to disrupt myself. And they say, really? No, really, we like you right where you are. I've now read Innovator's Dilemma by Clayton Christensen, which obviously has become a formative book for me, and realized that probably to move forward, I'm going to have to take a step back. So that was one thing that had happened, is I wanted to do something else and I realized they weren't going to let me do something else. I think there was also an element of hitting the glass ceiling. And for anybody who's in their 20s or 30s, they don't believe that the glass ceiling exists. And then you hit your 40s and you're like, oh, that's what everybody was talking about. I think I was hitting a glass ceiling, that, you know, there were things that I needed to change to manage my career better, but there was something systemically happening. I think also there was an element of, I was a little bit burned out. At this point, we're talking 2004, our kids are 8 and 4. I'm traveling all the time. I was probably a little bit tired. So those were all the pushes. But I think that there was a pull too, of there was, I was late 30s, early 40. And so developmentally, there's something that's going on from an Eric Erickson standpoint, is that when you hit that part of your life, we oftentimes call it midlife crisis, but it's a real thing. And there's this developmental thing that comes along for us. It's like, what am I really going to do with my life? And I think that was also kind of bubbling up for me, of what am I really going to do? And sort of these entrepreneurial, who am I going to be? What do I care about? And around that time, I guess one other element to the story that I think fits in, and I alluded to this earlier, is we had been doing a training internally, and I remember training some of my equity analyst colleagues were picking stocks, and this is at the zenith of American Idol. So it's like 2003, 2004, zenith of that. Then you've also got a brand called You coming out, or came out, from Tom Peters. And I realized that I was spending lots and lots of time thinking about what brand my equity analysts were, or my colleagues were. I'm like, wait a second. Okay, yeah, I know they're hiring me to pick stocks, but it seems like I'm a lot more interested in momentum and people. And I care deeply about, like, how do you as an analyst gain momentum? Are you, you know, a forensic analyst? Are you a great stock picker? What does that look like? And so I think there was some element of me of feeling like, okay, developmentally, what I'm going to do, what I really care about, what am I passionate about? And so the confluence of all those factors, I did something incredibly foolish, which is I'm making a lot of money. I go into my boss and I say, I'm going to leave. And I jump off the cliff. I disrupt myself with no real plan other than, I'm going to be an entrepreneur. Sometimes that's what you have to do. It looks very foolhardy in retrospect, but sometimes you just have to do it because you know you have to do it.
You did not have a job lined up at this point, right? Or you hadn't started a side hustle or anything like that. And so what happened next?
My plan was, and now it just sounds so pie in the sky. So we were going to produce a reality TV show about soccer in Latin America, kind of like soccer meets American Idol. And we had pitched it to Televisa, which I was covering, but they really weren't interested. And then I was going to write a children's book. And then we started a magazine called Organized Magazine, which at one point it got up to circulation of 100,000, but no plan. And at one point I could have gone back to work on Wall Street. I had a couple of firms reaching out to me, but here's what I knew. When I left, I did not take any of my financial models with me, which tells me that subconsciously I knew I was done and I wanted to burn that bridge. And so I had a couple of years where I just kind of, I was at the low end of that new learning curve and figuring stuff out and decompressing. But during that time period, I connected with Clayton Christensen, the legendary Clayton Christensen at the Harvard Business School, and was working with him on a number of nonprofit projects, specifically within our church. And he wanted to launch a fund with his son, Matt, who was just graduating from business school. He knew I had a Wall Street background. And because he trusted me, he said, why don't we do this together? And so about 2 years later, we started to launch the Disruptive Innovation Fund. But there were a couple of years of just sort of, oh, I'm not sure what that looks like. And that's what happens when you are starting something new. There tends to be a period of this sort of miasma, this primordial soup of you're like, I don't know what I have, but you know that you'll eventually figure it out.
Eventually you landed on disruption and personal disruption specifically. But I want to talk about the term disruption for a moment. We often hear that term being used in the business context, and it's become somewhat of a buzzword. What does it mean exactly?
It means, as a term of art, how Clayton Christensen uses it is, at its simplest, a silly little thing, something that people dismiss almost like a toy that somehow upends an industry. So great examples of that are the telephone disrupted the telegraph, and the light bulb disrupted the gas lamp, and the automobile disrupted the horse and buggy. But more modern examples or corporate examples are Netflix disrupted Blockbuster, and Uber is disrupting cabs, and Amazon may yet disrupt Walmart. But when those things started, in every instance, the common perception was, this is a silly little thing, no big deal, nothing to worry about. But what ends up happening is that just as the incumbents were motivated to go after bigger, faster, better, and to cede the low end of the market to those low-end disruptors, once you gain that foothold, you also are motivated by bigger, faster, better. And so that's what the theory of disruption is. And the reason that it's so robust, if you go back to Innovator's Dilemma by Clayton, is that he states, and this is basically based on his PhD dissertation, is that when you pursue a disruptive course, when you do that low end, when you play where no one else is playing, your odds of success are 6 times higher. And your revenue opportunity is 20 times greater. So that's the sort of math behind the theory and why it's been such a powerful paradigm for people to use. But from a term of art perspective, it's the silly little thing that upends an industry.
And what does the term mean when applied to the personal context?
Personal disruption is how you take all these ideas and make them meaningful to you. So what does that look like for you personally? So you start at the bottom of a ladder, you climb to the top, and then you jump to the bottom of a new ladder. And a great example of that is Lady Gaga, to think about that like for a person. Because if you look at her, you're like, okay, so 2008, she goes to the top of the charts, but she doesn't just stay there doing the exact same thing. She jumps to the bottom of a new chart, one that could have put off her fan base entirely, because she collaborates with Tony Bennett on a jazz album. She does a Sound of Music tribute. All right, we're talking Lady Gaga, Sound of Music. And then she produces a country album. But every single time she jumps to that new ladder, she's expanding her fan base. And it absolutely paid off, because her performance at the Super Bowl in 2017 had the largest music audience ever. And then she did A Star Is Born. And so personal disruption, that's what it looks like. It's this cycle of learn, leap, and repeat. Now, the big difference between personal disruption and when you've got a product or a service or a company or a country is that you, Ozan, are Netflix and your Blockbuster, your Uber and your cabs, the silly little thing, and you take over the world, because you're always disrupting you. You are disrupting you when it comes to personal disruption. But when you do, your odds of success are higher. And crucially, you're happier because every time you learn, you get dopamine. And so you learn, you leap and repeat over and over again, because when you do that, when you disrupt yourself, you literally chemically, you get the feel good effects of happiness that come when you learn.
I love the Lady Gaga example. I actually remember seeing her in early 2008, I think, when way before she was like at the top of the charts in this tiny venue in San Francisco. And of course, she won't be playing those tiny venues anymore. And then another example that came to mind as you were telling the Lady Gaga story was Steve Martin. It took him a while to become an amazing stand-up comedian because he was trying to disrupt that industry. I mean, that industry was dominated by comedians who were following the standard formula for jokes. You know, you build tension and then you have a punchline at the end. And Martin wanted to do stand-up comedy without any punchlines. So created this new form of stand-up comedy, became really successful. And then he quit. Just one day he said, I'm going to quit. And then he became an actor and, you know, he started doing music and he won all sorts of awards. And at every juncture, he kept disrupting himself and beginning from scratch. Now, you mentioned some of the upsides of personal disruption, which is, you know, the odds of success are higher. You're getting a dopamine every time. What are some of the downsides? And we can approach this from a number of different angles, but one that comes to mind is the fear that comes with, and this is true for you as well, Whitney, you know, you were at the top of your game on Wall Street. Steve Martin was at the top of his stand-up comedy game, and then you jump. What's going on through your mind and what are you fearing might happen? And then we can get into sort of like why people are reluctant to make those jumps, but that might be a good starting point.
Let me set the stage a little bit. So if you think about this idea of disruption, I want everyone to picture kind of this y-axis of, you know, success. And then you've got this x-axis of time. And so whenever you are disrupting yourself, you're basically saying, okay, right now on the y-axis, I'm at 10. And I think that over time, I'm going to go over one, up one, over one, up one. So there's sort of this trajectory that I'm on. But when you do personal disruption, you're making a calculated risk of saying, I know I'm at 10 and I'm at over one, up one, but I'm going to move from 10 down to 8. Because I believe that in the future, I can go over one, up two, over one, up two. So the slope of my line or my trajectory or my success will surpass where I am currently. But you've got to go from 10 to 8. And so that's a big deal because it's like free fall from 10 to 8. And so, of course, it's scary because you're on this perch of who you are and you're going to go to who you can be. But in that moment of free fall, there is this huge loss of identity. There's possibly a loss of stature. There is a loss of stature to the broader world. And there's possibly some financial impact of that. And so it is very scary. But the reason you do it is because you believe it's just like when you make an investment as a business, you know, you discount your cash flow back and you think in the long term that makes sense. But in the short term, you have to part with that cash. So that's where the fear comes in. What I would say, and something I've thought a lot about, is sometimes we're good at disrupting ourselves by saying, if I do this, look at all the upside. But something that I've learned, not only from looking at the work of Heidi Grant and Tori Higgins, but also looking at loss aversion theory with Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, is that we all know that we're more motivated by what we lose than by what we gain. And so one of the best ways to actually motivate ourselves to make that jump when we're afraid is to look at what we lose if we don't jump. In other words, if I think I'm at a 10 and I'm scared to move to an 8, well, if I don't jump, I might get pushed off and get moved down to a 6. So maybe better that I orchestrate this on my own, pack a parachute, get to that 8 in order to move up. And so that's one of the ways for people who are afraid, instead of just thinking, oh, I'm afraid to jump, say to yourself, okay, but if I don't jump, what might happen? And that's a hard exercise to do, but it is actually incredibly motivating to get ourselves to disrupt ourselves. Because again, with personal disruption at its essence, you're basically stepping back from who you are today to slingshot into who you can be, whatever that looks like.
Looking back on your life, can you think of any instances where you could have disrupted yourself? You could have done this move from a 10 to an 8 and you didn't, but you should have?
So the first one is when I was in high school, and I was a junior in high school, and I was getting ready to go into my senior year, and school was intense. And my mom, and again, this is a long time ago, my mom talked me out of taking calculus because it was going to be too hard. And I think about that a lot. As you can imagine, my children were expected to take calculus because as a consequence of not moving into calculus as a senior in high school, my confidence eroded in terms of my ability to do math. That continued to play out because, you know, the more confident you are, the more confident you become, the less confident you are, the less confident you become. I mean, there's this cumulative and compounding effect. And so that's one area. And I know it sounds like a simple thing, but it actually really affected me. Another time I think of is when I was in college, where I was about to graduate and I went to this information session on law school. So I'm hitting on all your buttons right here, right? If only I had grown up in Istanbul, I might be a different person. But I was in college and I went to an information session on law school. And actually, it makes me cry as I'm thinking about this. And I remember going to that session. And it was really interesting. And the thought of going to law school was very exciting, but I actually never even seriously considered it. And the only reason I can think of that I didn't consider it was that I didn't think it was something that I could do. It wasn't something that was available or accessible to me. It wasn't really within my realm of possibility. And I know that a lot of people decide they don't want to continue in the law, but when I look at law school and the training that comes with that, whether people decide to practice or not, it is invaluable training. And it makes me sad that I didn't believe that that was in within the realm of what I could do. So those are two examples, but as you can tell, I mean, you can hear the emotion in my voice. They're both poignant and important examples for me.
One of the most remarkable things is so, you know, you're sitting in this information session for law school. And yeah, just to circle back, you went from that to being a secretary at a Wall Street firm, being surrounded by a bunch of men. And yet, you know, at that point, you said, you know what, I can do this and I can rise through the ranks, which is exactly what happened. So I guess the question then is, like, what changed between the information session for law school and in your time on Wall Street?
Yeah, I think a couple things changed. One is that necessity, reality, right? So now we're at this place where, you know, we're in New York. My husband's getting his PhD. Our annual stipend is $14,000. So like someone has to, you know, put food on the table. So now we've moved from just, you know, am I going to get a job or am I going to do something, right? So there's this sort of necessity that of like, okay, I'm here, I have to be here. So I might as well make something of it. So I think necessity was really important. And the other thing that I think was important in retrospect, and when I looked at the information for law school, I was already married, but it was, you know, I hadn't been married quite as long. And I think this goes back to this idea of our ability and willingness to take on things that are hard and scary and be willing to fail, is that my husband was an important grounding influence for me in terms of my identity and my sense of self, which I think is so counterintuitive for a lot of people. They think, oh, especially for women, if you get married, you're going to lose your identity. But for me, it was the exact opposite. For me, you know, my parents had gotten divorced. They didn't have, you know, a great marriage. And I was the oldest child. So there's a lot of sort of moving, shifting pieces, not a sense of sort of groundedness. And I got married. And I think for the first time, I really felt my sense of identity starting to take root. And so I think the combination of necessity and this burgeoning sense of self, that is, and then, oh, also one other thing I would add is my mom had always worked throughout my life. Typical jobs for women at that time. She was a teacher. So she's basically a peer of the notorious RBG. But she was a teacher and she, you know, worked as a retail clerk. But I think that sort of, you know, have, if you can see it, you can believe it. My mom had always worked. And so again, those three things coming together, they all kicked in. And so that's when my ambition started to, I felt like, you know, I didn't have to hide it anymore. I could start really going for some stuff.
I'd love to transition to talking about failure for a number of reasons. One, that's the theme of this podcast, but also I think that you already mentioned this, but the fear of failure is one of the reasons why people are reluctant to disrupt themselves, because, you know, when you've been successful for a while, that the complacency can kick in and you're in a comfortable position. And so why change things and risk trying something that may not work? And you've got a great chapter in your book, Disrupt Yourself, called Give Failure Its Due, which I highly recommend to the listeners here. So I'd love to talk about failure. Looking back on your life, what stands out as one of the most valuable failures, and what makes it valuable?
I was giving a speech probably 4 years ago, I think, and they didn't like it. They hated it. Like, they literally hated it. Like, I was the lowest rated speaker of the entire day, and the comment cards were just brutal. What was so interesting for me, and you know, I'm a musician by training, right? Like, you're supposed to be able to give good speeches. The reason that was so important is because I recognize that in my trade, in order for the ideas that I have around personal disruption, around the S-curve of learning, in order for people to buy into these ideas, to adopt them, they need to not only be instructed, but they need to be inspired. And part of the reason you do keynotes is because there's that moment. If you do it well, it is like a piece of music and people feel inspired. And in that moment, I realized, after I got the comments and it was so difficult for me, it forced me to go back and say, okay, what do I have to do? Because I'm not inspiring people. They're saying I'm an automaton. They could have just put up a video because that would have been better. Like, it was brutal. But without that, I would have just kept on getting a little bit better, kind of notching up. And this forced me to completely rethink it. Now, the content was not the problem. The content was good. The content was robust. It was how I was delivering it. And what I later learned when I studied the work of Donald Miller, who wrote a book called Story Brand, which is the reason that speech had failed so miserably, is that I was making myself the hero. And therefore, the audience had to be the guide to me. And the audience, when you give a speech, always must be the hero. And so I was like, okay, so I have to make sure that I'm telling these stories and delivering this content in a way that you who are listening get to be the hero of the story. And I'm the guide, I'm the listener. And so it forced me to really rethink how I was delivering the content in a way that it could inspire people. And so that failure was really important, because without it, I wouldn't have torn everything apart and said and analyzed and dissected and said, what do I have to do differently? Super, super valuable, super painful. But, you know, I was talking to Price Pritchett the other day, who's basically specialized his entire career in mergers and acquisitions and change management around that. And he said, always move toward the pain. Look for where the pain is, because the pain is where there's movement. And that was absolutely true. Because there was pain there, there was movement. So that's the first story. So for all of you who are listening, if you ever bombed a speech, use that, because it's going to make you a much better speaker. The second one was when I was in this entrepreneurial period, and we had an entrepreneur come to us and say they wanted to start a magazine. It was called Organized Magazine. This was like 2006. It was a really good idea, because the job that you were doing is helping people feel more organized, and magazines had not been completely disrupted yet. Got it to circulation of 100,000. But the failure there is that the people that we were doing it with, we did not negotiate with them very well. I didn't remember that even though this is their dream, I need to make sure that I'm protecting the interests of our family. I was too kind. I didn't have boundaries. That was an important lesson. But the second lesson, I think, was even more important, is that my husband had advised against it, but I just full steam ahead and didn't really consult with him. And so the lesson there learned was not only that he needed to make sure that he speaks up to me when he disagrees, but that I needed to make sure that I listened to him and I respected his opinion, and that we had a real discussion about what we were going to do. Because financially, it really set us back significantly. It was very hard for both of us, very painful, but it taught us a really important lesson in terms of boundaries and respect for one another's opinion. And so as a consequence, now, the most important relationship I have in the world, which is my husband, is that I do not make big decisions now without consulting with him and getting his opinion and making sure that I seriously listen. And if it's really big, I don't do it if he says, you know, please, absolutely not. And so super hard, but again, really, really valuable.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I'm the same way with my wife. I don't make any major decisions without consulting her, because I find that I'm just way too close to my own perspective to be able to see the flaws in my decision-making process. It's like trying to psychoanalyze yourself. It's really hard to do. My wife knows me better than I know myself. And so, you know, she is the first reader of anything I write. And every decision I make, every major decision I make goes through her. And I'm a better person as a result. We're coming to the end of our time here, Whitney, but I do want to ask you one final question, which is based on your book. And as I was reading your book, one of the sentences in the failure chapter really stood out to me because it's such a contrarian message. You say that it's important to grieve failure. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on that a little bit. And the reason for this is the celebrate failure, fail fast, fail often mantra is so popular these days in Silicon Valley. People are holding like parties, or funerals that are parties for failed startups. And so this celebratory atmosphere has surrounded failure, at least in some circles. But you mentioned in the book that it's important to grieve failure. Why is that?
Well, I do think it's a both and. I think there's something to be said for, okay, it didn't work. What did we learn? This is helpful to us. There's an ROI on this not working. And then there's the other part that I mentioned, which is if you're doing something and it's really worth doing to you, you have put your heart and your soul into it. And when it doesn't work, to pretend like it doesn't matter denies who you are and what you care about, and you sublimate that grief, then you sublimate your ability also to really have joy when things do work. And so it's that ability to honor the sadness that you feel, that this mattered to me, I cared about it, and to also ditch the shame. So we're not talking about shame. This, I cared about it, this mattered to me, grieve it, be sad about it, because all of that energy that you have around that grief, then you ditch the shame, because the shame is about identity and this is not about your identity. It's just about it. It didn't work. But then that energy that you feel around the grief then gets transformed into the energy that allows you to then move to your next thing. So there's a lot of power in that. And if you try to sublimate it, if you try to ignore it, it comes out in ugly ways. And what you want to do is channel it into allowing you to disrupt yourself and to move into that next S curve of learning. And so it's very important that we allow ourselves to feel that sadness, because that's part of the process. And it's that energy around that that's going to give us what we need to do, whatever we're going to do next.
Well, I think that's the perfect note to wrap up this conversation on. Thank you so much for joining us, Whitney. If people want to learn more about you, your books, your podcast, where can they find you online?
Thank you for asking. It was on. I have a podcast as well. It's called Disrupt Yourself. And so you can find it anywhere. But if you want, you can also go to my website, whitneyjohnson.com, and you can find the podcast. And in particular, what you all might find interesting is I have a solo episode. It's episode 120, where I talk for 30 minutes about how to play to your strengths. And so I would recommend that to you all as you're thinking about how you can learn and grow and develop. You need to be able to play to your strengths. And then when you fail, use your strengths in order to move forward. So I would recommend people take a look there.
Excellent. And I will make sure to put all of those in the show notes, including a specific link to the solo episode that you mentioned. Whitney, thank you so much again for joining us. This was so much fun.
Thank you for having me, Ozan.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. Two things before you take off. First, if you don't want to miss out on future episodes of Famous Failures, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on, and be sure to leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. Second, if you'd like to join thousands of others who receive a short email from me each Thursday with a list of articles, books, tools, quotes, and other gems that help you discover how extraordinary thinking produces extraordinary results, you can text my first name, which is Ozan, that's spelled O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. So once again, that's my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. Or if you're in front of your computer, you can head over to ozanvarol.com and drop your email address. If you act now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles to Innovate Your Thinking. As always, thank you for listening and see you next time.